Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello, my name's Adrian Goldberg. Thanks for downloading the 5 Live Investigates podcast. This week, doorstep charity bag collections and claims that hundreds of thousands of pounds are being diverted from good causes by rogue operators, keeping the bulk of the profits themselves. Now, we all get them through the letterbox, don't we? Charity bags, asking for our unwanted clothing to raise money for good causes. Around 125 million are delivered each year, often by private fundraising companies who give a share of the money they raise to the charity whose name is emblazoned on the bag. Many firms generate vital cash in this way. But 5 Live investigators discovered that some collectors hand over only a fraction of the money they raise to charity, sometimes less than 10%. Others are breaking the law, operating without licences. A few are even involved in the trafficking and exploitation of vulnerable workers. We can also reveal today that one of Britain's biggest charities, the NSPCC, is now backing calls for a full investigation into the sector. And as ever, we'd love to hear from you this morning. Do you leave bags of clothes and other unwanted items for charity collectors? And do you mind how much goes to charity? Or are you just happy to declutter and recycle the stuff that you don't want? You can text us on 85058, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk, on Twitter, we're @BBC5Live, or on Facebook, BBC Radio 5 Live. So how much do you know about what happens to the clothes you donate? I've been asking these people in Manchester.
You call them begging bags?
Well, charity bags.
Do you ever fill those up?
Yeah, we get them at home, yeah. Yeah, fill them up, and then they're gone the next day, so...
Are you worried about where they go to or where the money goes to?
Well, it's out of your hands, isn't it, unless someone else is selling them to make a few bob. If some poor kid in Africa is getting a jumper out of it, I don't mind that.
If I was to tell you that in some cases, the charities that are named on these bags get less than 10 pence in every pound of the proceeds, what would you say?
It's shocking. Where does the other rest go? To someone driving about in a big limo?
At 5 Live Investigates, we found that in some cases, the amount of money going to the charities named on these bags can be 10% or less of the total proceeds. What do you say to that?
I think that's shocking. Oh, God, it's tricking people into giving their money, their belongings for a charity, and it's not even going there. That's absolutely disgusting. I can't believe companies can get away with that.
Do you ever fill any of these up?
I do, often.
How often would you say?
Twice a month.
Really?
Because the charities have been good to me, particularly Macmillan and St Anne's Hospice, and I just think they're very, very worthy charities.
If I were to tell you that in some cases, as little as 10% or less of the proceeds actually goes to the named charity...
Horrifies me. The charities need 100% of the money. Much prefer to give directly into the shop. Sometimes it's a bit of a pain, but at least I know that my items are actually going in the shop, and I like to see my items in the shop.
Oh, lovely. Well, you're very well dressed, madam. I'm sure somebody, when you decide the time has come for your fur coat to go and your coat with the fur collar, it'll be the...
Oh, I'll be giving this one away, I tell you.
Now, charity bags are big business. Clothes recycling is an industry reckoned to be worth more than £150 million a year. Just one load filling up the back of a transit van might fetch up to £600 or £700 when they're resold. One of the big players is Clothes Aid. Since they were founded in 1996, they've raised more than £10 million for major charities such as the NSPCC and Macmillan Cancer Support. I joined up with Sylvia and Alex on a collection round in Chorley in Lancashire.
When we start collecting, we see the bags, and if someone come out the door, we show the ID. We are from Clothes Aid. If it is more bags, it's good for the company.
So just the one bag there, Alex. Bit disappointing.
No, not at all. Because so it's matter. Every bag it's matter.
Let's just have a little look in the back of your van now. So pretty healthy. This is a transit van, probably half full. How does this rate as a day's collection?
For this day, it's not too good, but it's okay.
Are you ever full to the brim?
Usually, yeah.
roughly how many bags would you put through doors?
In my case, I post something about 1,200, 1,300.
Wow, that's a lot of bags. Ooh, in
daily,
a week.
Daily.
Start for the morning, 6:30, because it's coming another company. He want to steal the bags, and this is not fair.
You have rival operators who come and steal the bags that are meant for you at Clothes, eh?
Yeah. This is big problem.
A lot of money by this, and they are not thinking at our charity if they are stealing everything.
We just stopped here because there's on this curbside here another three bags
three
to collect.
Three bags, yeah. One, two, three. So I must go to help.
No, don't let me stop you. Have you ever had any confrontations about that?
Oh, yeah. They was collecting our bags. I asked them, can you show me the van? They tried to hit us. We stopped them, say, whoa, calm down.
How do you feel about that?
I am feeling angry because I'm walking every day. And when you see they stealing your bags, your work, I feel this, what I'm doing, I like it, what I'm doing. When people ask me, where are you from? I am proud to say I'm from Romania and I'm doing a good thing.
My name's Stephen Jenkinson. I'm the operations manager for Clothes. Currently, you're in the Blackburn warehouse. To the left of us, that is the main clothing pile. This is where we fetch all the door-to-door clothing.
Now, when you say a clothing pile, I don't think you're quite doing justice to the mountain of white and black polythene bags piled up almost to the height of the ceiling of this warehouse here in this corner. I don't know how many hundreds of bags are gathered up in that corner. Can you estimate?
I'd say there's about maybe 20 tonnes. You know, obviously, this bag's not been too long coming to the warehouse. Rip the bag off and obviously, yeah.
Well, it says Dolce & Gabbana bag, doesn't it?
Gabbana, yeah.
I mean, the people who pay good money for that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brand new, isn't it?
Brand new. Brand new top there for you.
Brand new, the tag's still on it.
Yeah.
Now, when we look at this bag that we've just dismantled with some brand new stuff in it, with a couple of very nice handbags and so on, being honest, to what extent do you think people are just doing a bit of house clearing and seeing a charity bag? To what extent are they putting it in the bag because they support your charity partners?
I think everyone's got their own personal choice because it's either something that's touched them. So obviously I think with Macmillan, a lot of people are touched with people having cancer in the family.
So you think people will see these charity partners on your bag and think they're going to specifically donate the clothes and other items for those causes?
I think some people don't. I think people just actually get the bag and put some stuff in, but you know, if people get a few bags through the door, I think they look at them and think which one touches them.
Now, listening to that is Michael Lomity. Michael is the business manager for Clothes Aid. The company has written to the fundraising regulator this week asking for an investigation into charity bags and clothes recycling, saying that legitimate charities are losing hundreds of thousands of pounds because of unscrupulous collectors. Morning to you, Michael.
Good morning.
Now, in some cases, charities do collect clothes themselves directly at the doorstep, but usually it's handled by fundraising firms like yourselves. Just so we understand the process, what happens to the clothes after they've been collected and stored?
OK, so there are two types of collections. You can take it to a charity shop, but Clothes Aid works for a handful of charities that don't have chains of charity shops. So we offer members of the public a really good opportunity to be able to support the charity without putting their hands in the pockets. Once we collect the goods, it's all aggregated into our warehouses and we sell it on into Eastern Europe.
OK, and the clothes are simply then sold on into Eastern Europe where they're then resold to people who are grateful to get cast-offs from a wealthy country like ours.
Absolutely. There's a huge demand for the product that we collect.
So how much then, after all that process, do the charities themselves receive?
OK, so after costs, Clothes Aid gives our charities between 80 and 90% of the profit. And we think that's a really good deal. The little bit we keep, we reinvest to try and keep standards up and to improve our business.
And we should explain, shouldn't we, that whoever the private fundraising collection company is, there are costs associated. You have to distribute the bags, you have to collect them, you have to store them. You know, it's not a volunteer operation. It's a big business.
No, it's huge. We've got a network of about 500 people around the country doing all the operations for us.
So you've written to the regulator this week asking for an investigation. What are you concerned about?
OK, so at Clothes Aid, we raise about £1 million a year. and we work really hard. And I do hold my hand up. Occasionally we make mistakes. We put a bag through somebody's door who's asked not to have one. And we've took recommendations from the regular on how to improve what we do. So we work really hard. We jump through hoops. We've got whole operations manual, lots of different systems to deliver the best service for our charities and to maximise the money that we raise for the charities. But what we see, we're really galled that about 60% of the competition out there is unlicensed. And we feel it's unfair, basically. We feel members of the public are being duped. We feel charities might be being misled as well, in that it's not clear. If they haven't got a licence, who's checking what sort of money the charities are going to get from these unlicensed collections?
So, in a sense, you're trying to play by the rules, and you're finding there are lots of other organisations out there aping your business model, but who aren't playing by the rules. And you've actually done your own research into this area.
We have. We often hear people say, oh, I get too many charity bags, there's a lot coming through the door. We've looked at the competition that's out there. Whenever we do a collection, we measure who's there, we take the name, and we'll check with the local authority whether it's licensed. And we came out, it was actually 63.8% of collections were unlicensed.
How much do you think legitimate charities are missing out on then with unlicensed or even just completely rogue collectors out there jumping on the bandwagon of what is ultimately a legitimate business?
Absolutely. I think people should realise that it is a great way to fundraise for charities. You don't have to put your hand in your pocket. You can get rid of all the unwanted clothes you don't need. If it's done properly, as I say, Close Aid, we raise about £1 million a year for our partners. We have really detailed contracts. The charities can see it. We're really transparent with them. And we put information onto the bag so the public can understand how much the charities are going to get.
But to go back to my question then, how much do you think charities are missing out on by people operating less scrupulously than you try to?
Right, well, if we raise it about £1 million just by our operation and 60% of collections are not licensed, you can imagine the scale of what's not going into the right channels.
Michael, we'll speak to you again a little bit later. Michael Lomity there from Close Aid. The NSPCC as well have told us today that they're backing Close Aid in their call for an investigation. They've written to the fundraising regulator, who we'll hear from later, saying the actions of unlicensed and unregulated collectors damages the trust of those who donate the clothing, and that it's also having an impact on how much charities receive. Getting your reaction as well this morning, text us on 85058 or on Twitter at BBC5Live. It's 11:18.
Across the UK.
This is BBC Five Live. Five Live Investigates.
Yeah, this morning on Five Live Investigates, hearing calls for an investigation into doorstep charity collections. Some private fundraising firms are raising millions for charity by recycling clothes and other unwanted bric-a-brac, but others are diverting the bulk of the proceeds into their own coffers. As we've heard, charities are missing out on hundreds of thousands of pounds, maybe even millions of pounds, as a result. Now, the law on this dates back to the 1939 House to House Collection Act. This says that anyone collecting door-to-door for charity in England and Wales must have a licence from a local authority, unless you're a larger charity, when you might be authorised by the Cabinet Office. And there are similar rules as well in Scotland. But there are plenty of people out there willing to risk prosecution, even though in theory they could be fined up to £1,000 and jailed for 6 months. One private fundraising firm, Close Aid, says they've got evidence of nearly 450 unlicensed collections being carried out in the last 3 years. Now, we had a tip-off that a company called NNA Recycling Limited was carrying out unlicensed collections in Trafford in Greater Manchester. We checked with the council there, and the company doesn't have a licence for that area. So on Thursday, we decided to see if we could catch them at it. My producer, Paul Grant, was keeping an eye in a street where householders had bagged up their unwanted clothes, and he confronted the collector.
I'm not stealing collections.
I'm just worried. I live in the area and I just worry.
Ah, all right.
So you've got a licence here to collect this?
Yeah, that's my idea. Leukemia.
Do you mind if I just have a look?
Yeah. Share it with my child.
Ah, right, OK. And you're just collecting around here?
Yeah.
OK, thank you.
Now, during the course of that conversation, the collector showed Paul a photo ID card. Fair enough. But the point is that the company which left out the bags he was collecting, NNA Recycling, don't have a licence to collect in that area. And it's not the first time NNA have done this either. They're also on a list of unlicensed operators posted on the website of Tandridge Council in Surrey. So I went to visit the company's warehouse in Manchester, was told to speak to two of the company's directors who were on holiday. When I phoned them and asked for an interview, they asked us to put our questions in writing, which we did. And they said they were now carrying out an internal investigation. And what about the charity they raise funds for, Leukaemia and Myeloma Research UK? There's no suggestion they've done anything wrong, but how do they feel about receiving cash from a firm willing to flout the law? Well, we emailed them, but we haven't heard anything back. Now, people in the industry have told us that one of the major problems with enforcement is that while local councils have responsibility for it, they don't have the resources to do the job properly. Peter Hills-Jones is head of compliance for the trade body, the Institute of Fundraising. He's been taking me through the rules.
Any collection has to be licensed. That can be either licensed by your local authority or within London, that will be the Metropolitan Police. Or for some of the larger charities, they operate under what's called a national exemption order. That's granted by central government and means they don't have to apply for individual licences. Now, when charities are applying for either a national exemption order or a local licence, they have to meet certain tests. And one of those tests will be indicating to the issuing authority how much money will go to the private company and how much will go to the charity. So it's all very transparent.
At the same time, though, we've discovered that one charity received £12.50 from £260 raised by one private company after it had taken out its expenses. On another occasion, £2,620 was generated by the private company, but just £250 went to the charity, less than 10%.
Yeah, and what's really important for listeners to understand is that it is for individual local authorities to determine what they think is an appropriate level. Any local authority that's issuing a licence can ask for information about the percentages that will be going to that charity. So one of the ways in which some of the charities work with the commercial companies is that the commercial company is effectively taking all of the risk. It's employing the staff, it's paying for the bags, it's paying for the collectors, it's paying to sort them as well. And so the partnership in terms of the charity is that while the charity is benefiting, that the majority of the risk is with the private company. But it is absolutely vital that those donating through this form of giving fully understand percentages that are going. And if they're not happy with that, they can obviously make their complaint to the charity or they can complain to their local authority.
But would you accept that if a charity is getting less than 10% of the proceeds of a collection, that that is not really what people expect when they are leaving clothes for a doorstep collection?
Well, certainly what charities need to make sure is that they are providing enough information for people to make informed decisions when they come to donate. And on that bag, you must put on what's called a solicitation statement. Now, that's a technical phrase, but what it really means in reality is it explains how much money will be going to the charity. If any of your listeners receive a bag and that statement, that information is not on there, that is a clear red flag that the individual organisation is either not legitimate or they're not following the rules.
You say that the regulation of companies who collect on behalf of charities rests with local authorities in the main. Do local authorities in these times of austerity have the resources to properly monitor this area?
Most likely not, to be honest. I think the concerns of the public that there are potentially people working out there who are not legitimate and potentially diverting important resources away from charities means that we certainly feel that local authorities should be resourced to do this work properly. I guess what we're really saying from the industry's perspective is that local authorities are struggling to deliver even their statutory services at the moment, and they are struggling to provide the right level of support to many charities to help them do this form of fundraising effectively.
Yeah, so that leaves us with a problem there, doesn't it? On the one hand, you're calling for greater enforcement of the regulation. On the other hand, acknowledging that the people who carry out most of the regulation, i.e. local councils, haven't got the wherewithal to do it.
So I think what we're really pointing to, again, is, you know, ultimately, if people are breaking the rules, that's a criminal matter. So, for instance, running an unlicensed collection carries a fine of £1,000 or six months imprisonment as well. So we are talking fairly serious infringements here. And what we'd like to do is sit around the table with with the police, with local authorities, and see if there is a way we can pool our resources, coordinate our intelligence gathering to identifying, you know, what we believe to be is a relatively small number of rogue operators who aren't playing by the rules. If we can get rid of those individuals, it frees up more resource to support the legitimate and wonderful charities that work in the UK.
That's Peter Hills-Jones there from the trade body, the Institute of Fundraising. Lots of you getting in touch to offer your comments this morning. One listener saying, I'm aware that these bags are often not collected directly by the charity. I turn the bags inside out, fill them up with clothing, etc., then take them directly into my local hospice shop where I know it will be processed correctly. Linda in Gillingham says, I left out 5 charity bags filled with good quality clothes. When I arrived home that evening, 1 bag had been taken, the other 4 had all been opened. My assumption was that the bag, which looked like a genuine charity bag, was fake and that whoever turned up just took the items they could sell. I will never leave bags out again. Another listener, though, saying, you know, if a charity only makes 10% of the profits, well, it's not costing me anything to get rid of unwanted clothes, and 10% for the charity is better than nothing. Keep your comments coming on Twitter. We're at BBC 5 Live, on Facebook, BBC Radio 5 Live, or on the text at 85058. So how much are charities getting from these deals, and how much are the companies making? The law says councils can refuse an application to collect bags from the doorstep if a company is making too much money relative to the amount given to charity. But how much is too much? Private fundraising firms, as we've heard, do have legitimate costs. They've got to buy the charity bags in the first place. They've got to get them delivered, then sorted and stored before they're sold on. But we've discovered that one company raised £260 from a doorstep clothes collection before passing on just £12.50 to a charity. That's less than 5%. Another had turnover of more than £850,000 in a year, but donated just £76,000, less than 10%. Let's speak to Sarah Meaton. Sarah is the licensing manager at Arran District Council in West Sussex. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
So you as a local authority have got the business of deciding whether a fundraising firm should have a licence or not. How difficult is it to apply the tests for a licence?
It can be very difficult to apply that test. There's a lot of discretion there, and obviously officers are reliant on the information that they receive with an application. We try to undertake what checks we can to ensure that companies are legitimate. But a lot of what we do relies on officers personally recollecting information from where they've seen problems in the past. And we're reliant on the information provided to us by the charity, by the collecting companies. And we're also reliant on them providing us with returns that are legitimate as well.
All right. So in a sense, then, you're relying on the honesty of the collectors. And if they're good, honest collectors, that's fine. If they're rogue operators, you may be unwittingly taken for a ride.
Exactly. It can be very difficult. And as local authorities, there's no national database or any way that it's very easy for us to share information about issues, because obviously one district might have problems with collecting companies. Another one might have exactly the same issues. Google is a very good friend to us, and we found some very worrying stories.
What are the cases that have given you cause for concern then?
We've had, when officers have been undertaking checks, obviously we keyword search on Google, we found issues connected with people trafficking, so people being trafficked to this country and forced to go out and collect these bags for no money. We've also found issues of very small amounts of money actually reaching the charities, so we've also had collection companies who failed to submit returns, or they have submitted returns, and when they have, the information's been very misleading. So when it's been scrutinised, we've realised, although on the face of it, it looks like the charity may receive a good proportion of money, they're not. That's just not the case.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of our listeners saying, well, look, even if a charity gets 10% or less, that's still money they might not otherwise have had. And it's been suggested to us that some local authorities will rubber stamp applications for a licence as long as a charity is happy to take the money from them.
We've had charities themselves make similar comments to us because obviously they need donations and they need money, but it's a question of transparency and the public understanding exactly what they're donating to, and also some pressure to ensure that the profits to these are limited and the charity is maximised on the amount that they receive a donation for. It doesn't seem right that somebody's making a huge profit, and I think people would think twice if they knew how much profit was being made and not ending up with the charities.
But from what you've said, even as the local council responsible for issuing licences, that information of how much the charity collects, or how much the private company rather collects, how much it then makes as a profit itself, and how much goes to the charity, all of those details are not entirely clear.
That's exactly right. And when you've got legislation that dates back to 1939, it doesn't equip us very well to be able to get our hands on the information. We need to be satisfied. That being said, there is scope for us to turn down or to revoke licences when they're issued, when we're not satisfied that people are acting in a fit and proper way.
Sarah, thanks for your time this morning. Sarah Meaton of Arran District Council in West Sussex. Five Live Investigates, the time now, 11:31. Yeah, morning, Adrian Goldberg with you here on Five Live Investigates today. How charity begins at home, but sometimes lines the pockets of private firms, taking advantage of the public's generosity. We're talking about those collections where you bag up clothes and other unwanted household items and leave them on the doorstep to be recycled. This can be a legitimate way of fundraising for charity, and there are companies out there who donate anywhere between 80 and 95% of their profits to good causes. But as we've been hearing, there are also rogue operators taking an excessive cut, or in some cases, breaking the law by collecting without a licence. It's left many householders feeling confused.
You call them begging bags?
Well, charity bags.
Do you ever fill those up?
Yeah, we get them at home, yeah. Yeah, fill them up, and then they're gone the next day, so...
Are you worried about where they go to or where the money goes to?
Well, it's out of your hands, isn't it, unless someone else is selling them to make a few bob. If some poor kid in Africa is getting a jumper out of it, I don't mind that.
Beginning your comments on this morning. Crazy Legs sends me a picture of a plastic bag that's dropped through their door in Salisbury 5 minutes ago. It says that for every tonne collected, £75 per tonne will be donated to charity. Crazy Legs says no idea if they're licensed or not, no idea whether £75 a tonne is a good return for charity or not. Lynn says, I never leave my filled charity bags for collection, whether I know they're charity bags or not. I live in a village. I used to leave bags outside, but saw unmarked vans collecting them. When challenged, they weren't collecting for charities. Now I deliver them to the local hospice. Another listener, though, saying these companies who are raising funds for charities are businesses and need to make a profit. You need to look at the company's accounts to put things in perspective as to operating costs. And at least the charity is getting something. If you want the charities to have 100%, take it to them. I hope the local commercial recycling and landfill sites and charities take a lot of donations to the dump, as it is not of a quality that they can sell. Keep your comments coming. You can text us on 85058 on social media. We're at BBC 5 Live. Now, it's not only charities and kind-hearted members of the public who are sometimes being exploited. We're aware that several police forces have investigated working conditions and pay for staff in the industry. Jūrate Grigalaitė was jailed for 3 years for trafficking fellow Lithuanians into the UK to work as charity bag collectors. Detective Sergeant Rich O'Brien from Avon and Somerset Police led the investigation.
The victims were Lithuanian nationals, men and women from 18 up to late 50s, early 60s. The way in which it worked, Jūrate was delivering charity bags, had to have workers to do that. They would get into vans and drive within an hour to an hour and a half radius of Bristol, delivering those bags and then subsequently collecting them once they were full. The contents of those bags were clothing that could be reworn, so it was high quality recycled textile, would then be exported to Lithuania and Eastern Europe.
And so these were people who were getting paid how much?
Some of them were getting just a couple of pence so they could go to the shop to buy cigarettes. They were eating potatoes for around 3 or 4 days or so, and that's all they had to eat. There were 11 people or so in a 3-bedroom semi-detached house, far too cramped. the conditions again in terms of sanitation. They were all using the same bathroom. Some of them were locked in rooms if they'd had a fallout with Urata. In effect, they sort of ticked all the boxes for a standard human trafficking offence.
Do you think that there are examples of human trafficking being involved in other charity bag collections going on now?
Yes, undoubtedly so. I've spoke to various forces across England and Wales and contacts in the National Crime Agency, and you speak to them and you look at the scoping reports and the assessments that they do using intelligence.
You believe there are elements of organised crime involved here?
Well, I suppose you look at what organised crime is. If you've got three or more people working together in a criminal enterprise who are making quite a large amount of money, it would be organised crime. And Urata, when she was prosecuted and found guilty at court, she was subject to a serious crime prevention order, which you would put against a organised criminal.
What is the scale of the profit to be had here by a company acting in a disreputable, maybe even illegal way?
The profit for each company would be substantial. The victims who I've spoken to talk about tens of thousands of pounds a month being made from this. Globally, the movement of clothing around the globe is a multi-billion pound industry. It's a massive, massive business that's extremely lucrative, and that's shown by people willing to move people from Eastern Europe into a house in Bristol to collect clothing and then send it all the way back to Eastern Europe. No one's going to do that if it's not profitable.
And you talk about organised crime. How far do the tentacles of this clothes recycling crime spread more widely?
In terms of in England and Wales, we look at this from a vulnerability issue with regard to the workers. So our first issue is safeguarding and vulnerability. Clearly, around that, you get other types of crime, assaults, neglect, etc., which is why we went into Urata in the first place. There's clearly tax avoidance at times. There will be money laundering. There will be fraud. There'll be identification issues with regard to documents, etc. And there's been issues with regard to territorial issues in the United Kingdom over who has what patch, and there's been violence associated with those. So in terms of where we look, it's about vulnerability and protecting the workers and ensuring they're okay, and pursuing human trafficking offences. The wider issue in that area, it goes into many areas of crime.
That's Detective Sergeant Rich O'Brien from Avon and Somerset Police. Now, Gerald Oppenheim is from the Fundraising Regulator, which sets and maintains standards for charitable fundraising. And Michael Lomity from Clothes Aid, who, as we heard earlier, is calling for the regulator to investigate the sector. Gerald, good morning to you.
Good
You've
morning.
Heard the concerns. Are you going to set up an investigation into this?
There are already rules that help charities enter into the right arrangements with legitimate clothes collectors like Clothes Aid. So those are already there, and we will make sure that those rules are followed by charities.
Sure, there are rules. As we've heard, though, there's widespread abuse of those rules. So are you going to be launching an investigation?
Well, we also heard earlier in the programme from Pete Hills-Jones about wanting to work with all the other players involved, and we'd certainly want to be part of that. Our role is with charities and the organisations they work with. If anybody thinks that there's a clothes collection going on that is somehow not legitimate, they need to report that to the police for all the reasons that the previous interview set out very clearly. But we will work with others to strengthen the sector. And all of this is about public trust and confidence in what charities do and how they raise their money.
Sure, you say that you work with charities. I mean, we've heard that charities are routinely accepting cash from firms, fundraising companies, who have been refused licences in some parts of the country. That's going on now. Isn't that an indicator that the system is being abused and needs to be thoroughly investigated?
Well, I think that's more an indicator that there are some charities around who don't understand what they should be doing, and that is to strike the best deal with a clothes collector that they can in the interests of the people that the charity is there to help. So we need to actually look at the rules around that and the advice and guidance to charities on that so that they do the right thing and don't just end up with 10% or less, but as Michael was saying earlier, actually get the 80 to 90% that ClothesAid would routinely offer them.
Mm. Just so I'm clear, though, you're not committing to undertake the kind of inquiry into this sector that both ClothesAid and the NSPCC have requested.
No, I'm not saying that. We're a small self-regulatory body funded by charities themselves. Our powers are very limited in that regard, so we have to work with others, as was said earlier in the programme, to look at what's going on. We can't deal with this on our own.
OK. Michael Lomity, then, the kind of inquiry that you're demanding, along with the NSPCC, it doesn't appear as though it's going to happen anytime soon.
No, I think what the IOF mentioned earlier on about getting people together, I think that's the way that we need to go. And we welcome what Gerald has just said, the regulator, that they're happy to sit with other people and we can share the intelligence that we've got, because we know that, as I say, 63% of collections are unlicensed. We know who these people are. We can share that information with bodies who are interested. There are regulations. Things do exist. People should have really clear, transparent contracts with their charities. If that doesn't happen, then we need to see more enforcement. We need to see more punishment of these people, especially for the crimes of being unlicensed. You know, it's a criminal offence, as been said.
Didn't we hear, though, as well from one local authority talking about the difficulty that they have collating information? Effectively, they're relying on Google. There's no national database to highlight abuses of the system. That seems incredible.
It is incredible. But can I just come back to the Act? I think I don't want to be disrespectful to Arran Council, but it is quite clear that in the Act that they can only give a licence if the remuneration is not excessive, if not too much money is going to the charity. They can refuse to give that licence, and they can take it a stage further and ask the collector to submit further information. They can also request them to come in front of the licensing committee of the council and be interrogated, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have spoken to the council about that and raised those issues with them, and they say that they do refuse licences and have, on occasions, interviewed people in front of the committee because of those concerns. I suppose the broader point is that many local authorities appear not to have the resources, or perhaps in some cases the interest. I mentioned that, you know, we've been told that many local authorities just rubber stamp licensing requests as long as a charity appears to be happy that the fundraiser is raising some money for them.
Yeah, it is quite surprising that they're not doing the job that they're meant to do, which is why I feel we're asking the regulator to give us some assistance with this. Do get people together so we can talk through what the issues are and see if we can find a way forward. Because at the end of the day, we don't want these people who are operating incorrectly to steal the charitable spirit of the UK. People should keep filling up these bags because it can really benefit charities, you know, especially the ones that we work for who don't have shops. It's really important for them to work with somebody like us who takes all the risk.
And this is the point, isn't it, Gerald, ultimately? You know, as a regulator, it is not to scare people off from filling up charity bags where cash might go to genuine charities at a reasonable rate. It's to inspire confidence that will always be the case.
Oh, absolutely, yes, Adrian, that has to be right. It is about public trust and confidence, and that's taken a bit of a battering where charities are concerned over the last 18 months or so. So we need to work with Michael and others, the police, the local government association, the Institute of Fundraising, to actually make sure that the rules that do exist are understood and that local authorities and the police, and we accept they're very, very stretched, take the action against the rogue collectors that has to be taken. They're the only people who can do that, ultimately.
Gerald, thanks very much indeed for your time this morning. That's the regulator in this area, Gerald Oppenheim from the fundraising regulator. Thanks also to Michael Lomity there from ClothesAid. I should say we did speak to the local government association as well, whose members issue licences in England and Wales. They said that with a 40% reduction in core government funding over the last parliament, councils are having to target enforcement at the most serious cases. But they say they are keen to explore information sharing methods to help identify bogus collectors. But charities and commercial firms routinely undertaking doorstep collections also need to think about what more they can do to help prevent individuals and firms abusing this approach. The time approaching 11:58.
Take 5Live on the go. On digital, online, smartphone and tablet. 5Live investigates.
Now just have a listen to this.
Or how about this? Or maybe you'd prefer this. Not very nice, is it? But at least we can turn it off. Imagine, though, living with that sound in your head all the time. Those are just some of the sounds experienced by the 6 million in the UK who suffer from tinnitus. But Five Live investigators have been told that many people are unhappy with the treatment they get from their GP. The British Tinnitus Association surveyed nearly 1,000 patients. 92% of them said they felt their doctor was dismissive, unsympathetic, or simply didn't have enough knowledge of the condition. So today, for the first time, they have published guidance for doctors to help them treat patients effectively. We're going to speak in a moment to Professor Chris Dowrick. He's a GP in Liverpool. First, though, Isabel Anderson, a musician who lives in Belfast and has suffered from tinnitus for the last 5 years. Isabel, good morning to you.
Hi.
So you're a musician, so this must be particularly galling and difficult for you. When did you first become aware that you had tinnitus?
It was about 5 years ago, and I got really bad wax blocked in my ear and had a really bad ear infection. And while I was kind of waiting for that to clear, I developed tinnitus.
Oh, my gosh. And just tell us how it affected your life. Just describe what it feels like.
Well, now it's a lot better, and I kind of rarely notice it unless I listen out for it or if I'm in a really quiet room. But when I first got it, it was really, really loud, and I found it really difficult to sleep. And it was obviously daunting for me because, like you say, I'm a musician. So,
can you just describe kind of, you know, what kind of, what the sound was like, how it was to cope with it?
Well, at the beginning, it was incredibly loud, and it was kind of like somebody holding a massive battery up to your ear constantly, day and night. Now it's more like kind of white sound, like white noise. And like I say, I don't really notice it during the day unless I'm in a quiet room, so it's changed a lot.
Mm. And did you go to your GP?
I did, yeah.
And?
They weren't particularly helpful, and they didn't refer me to see anyone. And I was just reading the new guidelines that the Tinnitus Association have issued for GPs. And, you know, one of the things that really struck a chord with me is that to be referred if you're really being affected psychologically, which I was.
How badly were you affected, would you say?
Incredibly badly. I became suicidal, and I didn't hardly sleep for about 2 months. So I definitely kind of probably had a breakdown. And I had to go and privately see somebody, even though I was a student at the time and really didn't have much money. I had to go and privately see someone before they really took it seriously.
Really? So, yeah, that lack of awareness really then from your GP?
Yeah, I think that my GP saw it like I hadn't had it for a very long time. So the way that I was responding to it wasn't appropriate.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work like that. And you kind of have to think about, because it's so subjective, it's like if somebody walked into a GP office and said, I'm really depressed, so depressed that I don't know how I'm going to go on. Well, you wouldn't just say, oh, well, people that have depression don't usually get to that point until way down the line, so you're just going to have to deal with it. And it's kind of a similar thing.
Yeah. Isabel, thank you for that. Let's Professor Chris Dowrick. Chris, is that a familiar story then?
It is, I'm afraid. Yeah, no, I'm very grateful to Isabel for explaining so clearly and cogently what she's gone through. I should say that I myself am someone who lives with tinnitus.
Really?
I don't suffer from it anymore. I've actually had tinnitus for about more than 10 years, so I know exactly what she's going through.
So what? I mean, I'm not, you know, being disrespectful in any way, but tinnitus is a condition, you know, that I'm aware of. It's not an arcane or an extremely rare condition, is it? How come GPs aren't aware of it or aren't sensitive to it, as appeared to be the case with Isabel's GP?
I think it's a very good question. I think it's partly because it's although it's a condition that those of us who have are very aware of it. It's not usually a serious or life-threatening problem. And I think it's understandable that many GPs will be focusing in their training or in their day-to-day work on problems that are considered serious in that way. Mm. But I think the point that Isabel makes is absolutely right is that certainly in the early stages, I think it's something that can be very, very distressing, very worrying, because you don't know what's going on, you don't know what's going to happen to you, how it's going to affect your life.
If there's something positive to take out of this, it's that both you and Isabel say that the situation is not as bad now as it was.
I mean, yeah.
Two questions occur to me. One is, what triggers it? And two is, how do you, in inverted commas, cure it?
Well, those are very good questions, and like many things in medicine, I can't give you a wonderful answer to either of them. I mean, there are certainly some things that trigger it, like sort of exposure to loud noises, machinery, or rock music, or whatever. But for most of us, including myself, there's no clear trigger. And in terms of cure, it's something that unless it's got a particular reason, which most cases haven't. It's not so much curing as getting used to it.
Mm.
And
so you have to kind of learn to manage it. Yeah. So there's new guidelines now for GPs. How are they going to help?
Well, I think they will help by making GPs raising it in GPs' consciousness, so the more GPs are more aware of it, so we're attuned to it, we'll actually listen when patients are talking about it. I think I'm absolutely the position about referring people sooner rather than later to ear, nose and throat specialists, but more particularly to audiologists, who are the people who can give you the most guidance and have got the most expertise in that. And I think people like the British Tennis Association have got very good, helpful information on their websites and materials, which I think can be beneficial and reassuring to a lot of people.
OK, Chris, thanks for your time. Professor Chris Darrick, thanks also to Isabel as well. I did just want to tell you about next week's Five Live Investigates. Also a bit of a health-related theme, because we're talking about the number of antidepressants. It's an incredible statistic that the number of antidepressants given to patients in England has doubled in a decade. And what's really intriguing about that is no evidence to suggest that more people are taking the drugs, but there is evidence that they are taking them for longer. So are you a long-term user of antidepressants? Let's hear your experience. You can text us on 85058 or email goldberg@bbc.co.uk. That's text us on 85058 or email goldberg@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening to the Five Live Investigates podcast. And don't forget, if there's something you want us to investigate, you can email goldberg@bbc.co.uk.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.